This episode series was done in partnership with and sponsored by Showtime.
The prison break effectively transformed Dannemora and the surrounding areas into a police state, with as many as 1,500 search teams tracking down the two inmates.
One of the most amazing things, I think, is the elaborate way they got out, cutting through a wall, going shimmying down six floors, then going through this labyrinth of pipes to pop out of a manhole on the other side. It seems impossible that they didn't have inside knowledge of the layout of this facility. Sounds like a dumb question, no. But was it common knowledge, the layout of this facility? Did inmates talk about this?
No. We don't have, you know, common knowledge of the layout of the prisons.
Right,
so for them to have that, it had to be somebody inside somewhere would actually give them this information, the maps of where what leads to what. That's the only way I could see that happening.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente.
I'm Laura Richards.
And it's me, Lisa Z.
And our guests,
New York State Inspector General Catherine Leahy Scott.
Deputy Inspector General James Davis.
Well, we're continuing our conversation about the escape from the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York.
So I have a question for you before you highlight key findings and recommendations. Who, in your view, was grooming whom?
Matt, both Matt and Sweat, but most regularly, Matt was manipulating Gene Palmer, who was the corrections officer that ultimately, unwittingly, we think, brought the blades in a package of hamburger from the tailor shop where Joyce Mitchell presented it to Gene Palmer. And because he was an escort officer, he had the unique ability to be able to move throughout the facility. He could leave the facility. He often did. He would come back. He moved paintings in and out, which was currency for Matt and Sweat. They both were very talented painters, and they made multiple paintings for different workers. So he was never questioned. He had 27 years of experience. So he was a highly respected corrections officer, and he thought that he was grooming both Matt and Sweat to give information inside the facility about gangs, about violence, about threats against this facility. When in reality, what we found and learned by interviewing Gene Palmer was he thought at all times he was in control of the situation, when in reality, Matt and Sweat were manipulating him the entire time, feeding him false information, but just enough information that it seemed like it would be helpful. And with that, Matt and Sweat would continue to garner this friendship with him. And ultimately, one of the things I thought was funny, at least, or amusing, was when he brought the meat. So we know that Joyce Mitchell brought in 2 pounds of meat and put hacksaw blades and other tools inside the meat. She left it in a freezer with instructions that it should be brought to Matt. That's obviously contraband. It shouldn't be brought. But
the meat itself,
the meat
is
itself
contraband.
Without blades in it. And so when Palmer brought it up and walked it right through security, he doesn't go through metal detectors. He avoids metal detectors. He's staff. He walked around them. He walked in and didn't even sign into the honor block like you're supposed to in violation of the directives and the rules. And he walked right up to the cell like he did regularly and dropped the meat off. And ultimately, they cooked that hamburger that night into a goulash, and Palmer admitted that he ate some of that goulash. So the very transport of the hamburger was fed back to Palmer that day. He was oblivious, and the danger with Palmer especially is he thought he was the smartest guy in the room at all times, and he was being manipulated the entire time. And without him, they wouldn't have had that access to the cells.
How's the portrait of Ruth coming? Ruth? My girlfriend? It's our anniversary next week. That's my only gift. Do you fucking promise you'd have it ready for her?
I'm fucking with you, Gene.
Fuck you.
Still trying. It'll be ready tomorrow.
Laura and Jim, I have a question about what Jim Davis just said. Do you buy that Gene Palmer presents himself as he's working these two inmates? I mean, wasn't he just kind of having a bromance with these guys? I just don't buy that this complacency and being with them day after day. I just get the feeling, and maybe it's because I've watched the show, that he was infatuated a little bit with Matt or connected to him as a friend, you know?
Well, I mean, it's hard to – one of the most effective tools in getting cooperation from somebody is building rapport. And it's a human bridge. And typically, it's a human bridge of kindness and respect and dignity. And it creates this sort of debt of gratitude between human beings. And it's used all the time in law enforcement in order to get people to talk when they've done bad things and to get them to confess. So it's not unusual that Sweat and Matt would be able to sort of use that against the corrections officer. But I do believe what James said about the fact that Palmer really believed that he was working them, because that is something we encourage. And certainly in that society, that closed society that is a prison, there are all sorts of criminal things going on every single day. And so the corrections officers, their job is to get intelligence, to find out what's going on. And even though the rules are that they're not supposed to form relationships or friendships with the inmates, those are the very tools that you use to get that information. So it's a double-edged sword. And it could have been a little bit of both, Lisa, but I do buy that his motivation could have been totally pure in terms of what his job was as a law enforcement officer.
Right. And it's all about relationships. This is a microcosm. This is a world within a world. Matt, it seems, was top dog, but Gene Palmer probably thought he was the top dog. And so that ego and narcissism, I think, talks to both of those individuals. And I think the grooming aspect, because it was your word, Catherine, but I absolutely agree. You know, when we think about Tilly and Sweat and the Matt dynamic, I mean, Tilly was 51, Sweat was 35. So there's this whole element of she genuinely thought he was in love with her, but he is writing these notes under what seems Matt's direction to seduce her and placate her and take her on a journey. And it was a much more strategized plan as opposed to what seems to be Tilly, who's looking for a way out. She was excited by his attention, according to various other inmates. She was just ecstatic and lit up with this attention. So it does seem to be grooming on multiple levels, but at the top of it, so you know, from what I can see and what I believe, Richard Matt seems to be the top dog, putting everyone to work, even with Sweat and his the physical aspect of what he's doing in terms of the tunnels. You know, he seems to be the person who's got all the puppets and knows exactly what's happening next.
And Catherine, can we turn now to your interview with Joyce Mitchell, Tilly, and what that was like? It's depicted very clearly in the series. And I'm just wondering your approach to talking to her, what you wanted to get from that interview.
Approaching an interview with someone like Joyce Mitchell, and we saved the larger interviews, if you will, for last, as you do in most investigations. There's a lot of information gathering first. We were in possession of a lot of the information, a lot of evidence that we were going to present to her. And so first and foremost, she was arrested and she had reached a plea bargain negotiation with the district attorney. And part of that plea bargain was that she needed to cooperate with me in my investigation to assist in finding out what happened and then for me to make recommendations and changes at the facility. So that was the context, if you will, that Joyce Mitchell had to sit down with us. So she was already in the Clinton County local correctional facility. She was in cuffs. She had an attorney that was with her. And then my team, we did not interview Joyce Mitchell during the manhunt. We did not interview her until after a plea bargain was reached with the district attorney. So that's just to frame it. So we had several opportunities to sit and speak with her. And she was a person who wanted us to believe that she was completely innocent of everything that had occurred, that these were things that actually happened to her, that she was a complete victim of what it was that these two inmates had done and that they had duped her and she had done whatever it was all unintentional and unwittingly, which of course we never believed at all.
This is why I feel like I'm sitting across from the only person who can help me here.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're different than these people, so.
Well, I'm trying to help. I mean, I'm the one who went to the cops. No one came to ask me. That's all I've been doing is trying to help.
Our approach was to at least get her to admit to some of her complicity in this escape. And it really was quite difficult and frustrating, I might say, that she's absolutely she's lying under oath, quite frankly. And when presented with receipts, if you will, from the store of buying hacksaw blades, it's then and only then that she gives us a quasi admission that, well, it was that, really? That could have been me. That really could have been me.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, but the thing is, I'm sure that the plea agreement mandated that she tell the truth to you or it could vacate the agreement. That's pretty risky behavior on her behalf.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I will also say that many times her attorney would take her out of the conference room. Without obviously being privy to those conversations, she would come back in. And I'm absolutely confident that her attorney would look at her and say words to the effect, you have to tell these people the truth.
Tell them everything.
Right.
Right. So. A lot of crocodile tears, a lot of blaming everybody else. There must have been someone else involved, but I can't help you. I don't know. They couldn't have just used what I gave them.
So the fact that she feels and was trying to convince others, including some other news outlets in which she was trying to portray herself as a victim, which is completely not believable based upon all the evidence that we had, that she not only was going to provide the getaway car at the precise time that they requested, but also to provide guns, ammunition, camping gear, clothing, maps, compass. She was definitely part of the escape.
And especially telling, and I think it is reflected in the series, she has a panic attack. The night that it happens, Matt says, it's going to happen tonight. You got to meet us. This is how it's going to happen. She goes home with her husband from work, and she starts to have a panic attack while they're eating dinner, which is understandable. Two murderers are about to escape, and she knows they're coming.
In fact, that day, with specificity, Matt gives her exactly how she should comport herself. You take your car, you pull it over to the side of the road, you get out of the car, you go on your cell phone, and you pretend like you're talking on the cell phone right next to the manhole that we're going to pop out of.
I live with regret every day and will for the rest of my life. I'm sorry. I've never been so disappointed in myself. And I not only let myself down, but my family. My husband and my children are my life, my world, my purpose.
But the fact she has that panic attack, I mean, that shows, you know, an element of fragility and lack of, I guess, whether she had thought the whole thing through from, you know, A to Z, or whether she only romanticized part of it and this was all about fantasy, but now the reality was kicking in.
Right.
She couldn't handle it.
Right. And that shows a lack of criminal experience. So no matter how well these things are all planned out, the fact is, this kind of leaks out that one of the people involved, at least, has no experience in these types of things. I mean, being a hardened criminal, it's built up over years. And being in prison as a prisoner helps sort of, we call it Crime U. Basically, it's Crime University. They learn from telling each other stories about how they were caught and how to avoid this in the future. But Joyce Mitchell, or Tilly, I mean, she didn't have that level of criminal sophistication. And so it came out on the night when everything was supposed to happen. As you said, Laura, before this, it was just a fantasy. Her wanting to break out of this small town, this existence that she probably hated, and her wanting to be, you know, young and vibrant and beautiful and all that, this was all tied into that dream. And it was just a dream, and she couldn't carry it through, but she still gave them the tools to get out.
She did. I mean, the fantasy reality is we know Jim from lots of crimes and, you know, whether sexually motivated homicides, etc. What's played out in someone's head is so different when it comes to reality. But of course, Matt and Sweat have each other as the echo chamber, as you say, in prison. But actually, Tilly has no one really in terms of who she can converse with. And her echo chamber is very much about, or has been up to that point, upholding the law and rules and regulations. Although that culture of complacency and carelessness also, you know, and the laziness that's around the prison, which I would really like you to both comment on, Catherine and Jim, because I think all of these elements just talk to the perfect storm. As you said, it's not one part. It's not just about what Tilly did or Joyce Mitchell, what she did or didn't do. It's not just about Matt and Sweat and what they did and didn't do. It's actually the whole culture. And it's this perfect storm that was created that enabled this to happen in the first place.
I absolutely agree, Laura. And one of the issues that stands out for me the most in this investigation was the lack of inspections that occurred relative to the cell block and the honor block. That to me was just so shocking, if you will, that there were scheduled weekly cell inspections that were to occur. And we and the audit team had decided to take the most conservative approach to come up with a number of how many times these corrections officers missed, if you will, the hole in the cell. And we had determined, based upon the evidence in the case, as well as the testimony that we had taken from Sweat and others, that there were at least 15 weekly scheduled cell inspections which occurred. And those cell inspections require the officers to check the bars, the sink, the toilet, the vent. It is required that they were to check the vent and nobody checked the vent. It was required that they check the vent from the catwalk. Now, keep in mind that the repairs had taken place within the cell and the vent had the bed pushed up against it. If you went to the catwalk, you would have potentially have seen the two cut holes in the cell. Additionally, the inspections, the nightly round inspections, again, taking the most conservative number, we estimated at least 400 inspections they missed Sweat out of his cell. Then lastly, there were random cell inspections that were scheduled. Every day, they would randomly have a number of inspections that would occur on cells. There's a lot of discretion that's involved in those types of random cell inspections. And interestingly, a cell that had been inspected the day before was again reinspected versus Sweats, who had come up on the random inspection. Also, Matt's cell came up on a random inspection in March of 2015.
Right.
He had the hole in the wall. They didn't find it.
Wow.
And to frame that too, when you go into these cells, they're 6 foot by 8 foot. Without being trained in searching a cell myself, it just makes sense that you would check the toilets, you would check the bars, and you would check any vents and pull their bed out and check the vents. They're all in a very tiny confined space, and knowing that was never done. But most importantly, with Sweat out of his cell in a conservative amount of nights, 85 different nights, they do multiple bed checks during the night where we know we interviewed the corrections officers that were assigned to that honor block. And they, as you can imagine, several times during the night, they have a night count where they have to have everybody stand up or sit up on their bed and they count that out between 10 and 11 o'clock at night. And then they're supposed to do it at least 3 more times during the night where they walk through and look for what is termed in their directives and rules and regulations, a living, breathing body. So obviously Sweat is out of his cell that entire time, almost every single night, and he's got a dummy in there. And they are allowed to tap on the cell bars, shine a flashlight in, kick the cells, poke him.
They're required to see flesh. And clearly they didn't because he had the dummy in the bed, but they are required to see flesh.
Absolutely. And what we learned from interviewing all the inmates in the honor block and interviewing Sweat was that the team that was assigned, and they'd been together for over 12 years, the two corrections officers that were assigned to that particular block never did any searches and never did their rounds after the night count between 10 and 11 o'clock at night until the 5:30 a.m. master count for the entire facility. So if they had done that, and there, we calculated over 400 checks that they should have done on random counts to look for a living, breathing body, they would have upended this and he would have been captured and Sweat would have been found out way earlier. Now, it was never done.
Sweat had, during his interview, had told us that Matt and Sweat would specifically stay up late at night painting, under the guise of painting, in order to see if rounds were conducted. And they knew that the rounds were conducted. Additionally, we interviewed former inmates who said the exact same thing to us, that they would do the initial round at the beginning of the night, they would do the last one before the morning check, and no one did their rounds in between. So we have corroborative evidence regarding how these rounds were never conducted. And again, I'm using that 400 number as the most conservative number.
Right. And even more importantly, the corrections officers that were assigned to that block, that honor block, weren't working 7 days a week. So there were nights that there were other relief officers that were there. And Sweat knew that those relief officers actually did the checks and they actually did the rounds. So they couldn't leave on those nights. And that's why we have, over the course of 4 months, there were some nights that he wasn't able to go because he knew, in particular, there was a female corrections officer known to our office who was very deliberate in her searches and always checked for a living, breathing body. And they didn't even attempt to go out.
But when
she was there,
she wasn't ever there when a search of the walls and the vents and the toilet and the bars were done.
That's correct. Right. She was on the night round. So she was responsible between the 10 o'clock and the 5:30 in the morning. She was responsible for the nightly rounds.
But to miss an 18 by 14, cut hole in Matt's cell, I mean, that's not small. That is really quite staggering. And the fact that there was an investigation previously into Joyce Mitchell and Sweat's relationship, and that didn't turn anything over. It was seen to be baseless. I mean, that was another clear opportunity, wasn't it, if that investigation were thorough?
Absolutely. And another one of our findings that was very shocking to us is when they actually did do cell searches, you can imagine even an 8x6 cell with all the items that an inmate collects over time, legal papers, private books, private items they've purchased, things that have been sent to them by their family. It takes a long time. If done right, a cell search should take 45 minutes to an hour. What we learned from our investigation and looking at the forms that were filled out during that time is that they were taking less than 2.5 minutes to search the cells, and that 97% of the time, they weren't finding any contraband. So we know they were just going back to that culture of complacency. They were going through the motions. They were maybe entering the cell, but they were moving some stuff around, but they certainly weren't doing a legitimate search. And that's one of the reasons, since the escape, with every academy class going into the Department of Corrections, we send lecturers out to train them and to warn them about what happened in this escape, so that this sort of thing doesn't happen. It's our continuing, besides the report, besides this investigation, is the continuing maintenance and making sure that we are continuously doing trainings and doing additional frisks of facilities. So since that time, we've instituted a policy where we randomly go out to different correctional facilities, not just Clinton, other facilities, and do massive searches, and we found similar problems in these other
and
facilities.
Are they trained? Are they trained at the State Police Academy? Where are they trained?
No, there's a specific DOCS training academy that all corrections officers have to successfully complete the academy. So there is no recruit that graduates from the academy without having a member of my office provide specific training as to the expectations of them and their reporting requirement to me as the state inspector general. We obviously use the Clinton Correctional Facility investigation as the springboard to discuss not only the complacency, but also the culture that you may be working as a new recruit with somebody who has been working in whatever facility for 10, 15, 20 years. You are the new breed. You are the new employees. You need to take responsibility for that which you observe and report it if you see something. Because, again, another shocking point that I need to make is when you come up on Dannemora, the Clinton Correction Facility, when you walk into that facility, it is very clear that it is a maximum security facility, and everybody forgot that.
But one question I wanted to ask is, could this lackadaisical approach to security be because of the kind of prison it was, this kind of honor block, privileged, the yards that they had? I mean, you know, Brett Johnson, who wrote the series with Michael Tolkien, told us that it took a very small amount of guards to manage a huge amount of prisoners out in those yards. So maybe because not a lot of fights happen, or because the prisoners are well behaved, that it had a they had a false sense of security that everything was going smoothly and nobody would be missing at bed check and nobody would be trying to escape.
Well, it's that going into a facility like that, working overnights without people checking on you during the course of the night. At the time there were no video cameras in the blocks. There would be no way for facility staff to know with assurance that they were doing their jobs and they were doing those sort of things. So that you get this overnight, everyone's always in their cell the next morning, right? Everyone is back. No one's ever gotten through the wall. It adds to a level of, complacency where they think no one's ever gotten out in 100 years. I don't really have to do my rounds. I don't have to do a legitimate check of the cells. And we're fighting against that constantly, that lackadaisical nature of that, and that it can be an unstimulating job, especially overnight, because all the inmates are in their cells and no one's checking on the corrections officers. You can see how they would fall asleep or have problems staying motivated and functioning like that. And we know that rules matter. You have to follow the policy and procedure. There's a reason you're checking for a living, breathing body. There's a reason you're doing a cell check. There's a reason that you should be checking the toilet and the vents every single time. And those are all laid out specifically. So that falls on the sergeants and the captains and the lieutenants and the directors to enforce that kind of insistence on following rules and regulations. And it just was not happening at that facility.
And to the point that was brought up before, in February of 2015, it was discovered that there may have been an improper relationship between Sweat and Mitchell. And it was rumors that were determined to have been baseless, but that had risen up to a management level. And there was not a significant or any real investigation that occurred. And there was evidence that was not properly evaluated. So it's not only on the level of the COs, but also management, that they failed another opportunity to discover this escape.
I would hope that this never happens again. If it did, I would hope it would happen here, as silly as that sounds, because the people of the North Country showed their true colors.
Interestingly, we had another complaint of a civilian having a relationship with an inmate at the Clinton Correction Facility. That woman, who, by the way, provided a tour of her job in the tailor shop to Patricia Arquette. So that's yet another interesting piece. She was arrested and she's being prosecuted. So it was another opportunity for us to see what exactly happened. The truth of the matter is, as much education as we provide, as much as we have directives and policies and procedures, and we have very good management, are we ever going to really stop what individuals do at any given time? I don't think so, but we are doing our best to ensure that these types of things don't happen. And I will say that that relationship and the prosecution, that occurred quickly as a result of the investigation that we had conducted, the first investigation. That happened quickly because we had, it was a correction officer that reported that relationship to our office.
Well, that's great. But what's amazing about that is that it really proves that relationship demonstrates that people on both sides of the equation learn from every event. And when I said before that prisons are crime universities, I am sure that everybody talked about how these guys were able to get away with it and how they did this long-term grooming and they got the person, the civilian, to actually get them things, that they were just going to do it again. And that was what their plan was right from the start. So it's just amazing. And it is very difficult to actually ensure that. And just like in every other aspect of law enforcement, as law enforcement and forensic tools increase, you know, in their effectiveness, the bad guys and the bad women will actually, you know, pivot and shift and learn and one up whatever the advancements are. So it's a constant battle back and forth.
But also nobody thinks that they're the problem.
And like the IG stated, the woman that entered the tailor shop, she was the first new hire after Joyce, after the escape. She was the first new tailor shop employee. And then when production started up again, meaning the production in the tailor shop started up again after the lockdown ended, she was working there and knows everything that just occurred. Obviously, it was the talk of the entire country, but also the talk of the North Country. And she begins a relationship with one of the inmates. It's stunning, but the system worked in that it was quickly reported. Any whiff of inappropriate behavior, and that's what we had happen here. We had a female corrections officer noted improper interactions, immediately spoke with her husband was a corrections officer, immediately spoke with him. It was reported. This woman was pulled out. An investigation was begun by the OSI unit, the Office of Special Investigations, in conjunction with us. She was quickly captured. She quickly made admissions. We were able to track down money exchanges that she had made with the inmate and phone calls, and she created a new identity. It's insane, but she was quickly captured and prosecuted and admitted her guilt.
But on recruitment, I mean, is there any psychological testing for new hires? Because it just seems to me there's certain personalities that are not suitable to be in a maximum security prison, you know, full of men.
Well, it's a unique situation, unique as I don't think the public really understands the tailor shops and the workstations within the facilities across the state, and I think across most states, where they have inmates working so closely with civilians. And part of what we recommended to the Department of Corrections was a civilian training academy.
Correct.
And with that civilian training academy, have them interact more closely with the corrections officers, because we noticed internally that there was a distinct breakdown and separation between civilian staff and correctional staff. And a perfect example is Lyle Mitchell. Lyle Mitchell, the husband of Joyce Mitchell, and when I interviewed him with investigators here, he knew that his wife was bringing in items to the inmates. He knew who specifically she was bringing it in for. He knew that she was bringing in eyeglasses and that she had ordered stuff off of eBay to bring in, and that she brought in food and coffee and those sort of things. He admitted those things. And then when I asked him, knowing all this, knowing that that was a security breach, asked specifically, would you have done anything different if it even meant turning your wife in or reporting that she's having contact and receiving paintings, by the way, from inmate Matt? Would you have done anything differently? He goes, probably not. It's not my job. That's security's job. If they had checked her bag, then she wouldn't have done it. And I told her stop doing it, but she kept doing it. It's just stunning. So civilian workers also have to take a part in security. And when they notice these things, they have to report them. And Lyle Mitchell was unwilling to do that.
Well, listen, we are running out of time, and we want to give you an opportunity to tell us anything that we've missed, something important that you guys wanted to talk about. James, do you want to say anything, to add anything to the dialogue that we've missed?
Matt had previously escaped from Erie County Correctional Facility back in 1986. He was gone for 5 days before they recaptured him. He was also in prison for murder of another American in Mexico, and he tried to escape from the Mexican prison and was shot. And then even in 2008, when he was on trial in Niagara County, he tried another jail escape attempt. So you have a background with a three-time attempted escapee trying to get, you know, he should have been treated more carefully within the system, but he had been there long enough that he warranted being on this honor block. And I think that's important. We've corrected that. And it's since that escape, but that was a little bit shocking to us that someone with an escape history like that was able to warrant having an honor block and be able to manipulate corrections officers the way he did.
Yeah, I'm glad you plugged that up. Yeah.
Right. He was meant to be tracked. He was meant to be tracked and he was flagged, allegedly. Both of them were. So I agree with you. It's a real irony.
We have a new process in place relative to those who are permitted to be in an honor block type of cell block facility. In the facility.
Great.
The one thing I would like to add is that although the issuance of my report came out in 2016, the continuation of the supervision over docs continues by me and my office. No one should feel that just because I've issued a public report that matters, that all matters have been taken care of and that this could never happen again. I sincerely believe that if Sweat had the opportunity, he would attempt an escape again because that is the mindset of that particular inmate. So therefore, it is my responsibility to continue the review of all the policies and procedures of DOCS Central as it affects all the facilities throughout the state of New York. Again, as we've mentioned, I train every recruit that comes out of these out of the academy. We have done a number of surprised and unannounced inspections of facilities throughout the state. Unfortunately, we have uncovered a few things that is still violative of the DOCS policy and actually common sense, quite frankly. And we will continue to do that because at the end of the day, I don't think anyone can really appreciate that which Jim and I understand when we walked up into the North Country, that the population up there and how terrified they indeed were as to these inmates that were on the run. And I will never on my watch allow that to happen, not only at Clinton, but anywhere else in the state of New York. And this is an investigation that I still continue to be open to this day until the day I leave this job.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. I appreciate that your dedication. I'm sure Laura and Lisa do as well. And I think it's amazing that you were able to do this investigation and be so thorough. And literally, not only was your report, you know, incredibly detailed and thorough, but it was beautifully written. And it's been described as if it was written by Thoreau. So that's an amazing thing. Coming from a professional writer, that's an amazing thing. So thank you very much for doing that because it formed the basis of this show, Escape at Dannemora. And I think it will forever be in the annals of now, not only criminal history, but also Hollywood history.
I thank you all very much for this opportunity.
I also want to give a thank you out to John Milgram in your office, Catherine, and Greg, your chief technology officer, for facilitating this. You guys have a very busy schedule and everybody worked together to make this possible. And I just want to thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
And I want to give a shout out to Governor Cuomo. I used to work for his dad years ago when I was in college and law school, and he was just an inspiration for me in my career. And I'm so glad that Andrew has followed in his footsteps.
And I just want to say thank you to Catherine and James for being so clear and open and transparent and trying to ensure that, you know, safety is the safety of the community, but also in prisons is the main priority. So thank you for your service and your commitment.
Thank you.
Laura. Thank you.
We appreciate you coming on Real Crime Profile and enlightening us and our listeners. And till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.